You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
I've been fussed for some time about some of the lack of normative direction to undergraduate education and in the academic world, and the economists tend to fuss me more than most people do in this domain. So it was a pleasure to pick up Professor Shore's book this summer, which I happened to actually read just after I'd read a paper by Robert Frank, which I think all economists know, but which was fairly disturbing for me to read, which is that confirmed that education, college education, can have an impact on people's ethics and morality, because it showed that after taking introductory economics courses, students' sense of altruism and personal ethics decline. So it's a confirmation that what we teach actually does have an impact. So I was very happy shortly after I read that to stumble across Plenitude, Professor Shore's new book, and which she's going to talk about today, and I'm very glad she's here. She was a colleague for many years at Harvard in economics and in women's studies, as the program was known at that time. And she is now a professor of sociology at Boston College, and she's the author of an enormous number of books. The Overworked American is probably the one that most people associate with her name, but I think this project is really important, and it's really exciting, a wonderful book to read, so I definitely recommend it to you. So thank you, Julia.
Great. Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to be here. One of the sort of sentiments that I came away from writing this book with was that the sustainability community and the technology community really needed to have a much closer relationship. I have a sense that that is beginning to happen, and I hope to be, you know, involved in trying to increase those conversations. As someone who has spent the last 15 years or so working on sustainability issues, I can say that among that community, sort of awareness of what folks in the technology world do is much, much less than it needs to be. And their understanding of, I think, some really important affinities and possibilities, I think, isn't really there yet. So, I don't want to speak too long. I'm going to first say a few words about what's happening to the planet and kind of the urgency of addressing sustainability, climate change, of course, but there are other issues as well. And then look at the what I call Plenitude, which is a kind of small-scale economic alternative or to the kind of large-scale system that we have today. So just going to run quickly through a couple of indicators. The first is Living Planet Index, an indicator of biodiversity. Basically, since 1970, there's been a pretty dramatic collapse in biodiversity, some actual new studies out this year as well about looking at species, both land species and fresh and marine species, really major collapse in biodiversity going on around the world pretty comprehensively, and what ecologists call a new mass extinction is already well underway. Second kind of indicator is one that has been gaining a lot of interest around the world. It's the ecological footprint indicator, not a perfect one, but it tries to basically measure the impact of a system either on the consumption or production side, depending on whether you're looking at imports or on a whole world basis, of course, those are going to be the same. Eco footprint analysis is the basis of the fairly well-known statistic that if everyone were to live like Americans, we'd need five planets. And this is these are the latest eco footprints per person by country. Of course, the U.S. has among the largest. There are a couple of small Gulf states that have higher per capita footprints, but of large countries, it's by far the largest. Probably the most important thing to get from this is the fact that a range of European countries, also Japan, countries who have roughly similar standards of living to the U.S. have eco footprints that are about half the size, and energy use accounts for the majority of that. So it is possible to live, a fairly high standard of living with a much smaller eco footprint than we have. The other, of course, major issue, which I'm sure people are extremely familiar with, is what's happening on climate and our failure to basically reach global agreements to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The red line is the so-called 350 parts per million pathway, which is what science is now suggesting we need to get to avert really catastrophic kinds of outcome on climate. And we've been basically unable to get anywhere near that in terms of climate negotiations. I mean, there are some positive signs on the emissions front, but for the most part, they come from the global downturn of the last couple of years. So what we know right now is the one sure way to reduce emissions is to have economic collapse, but that's obviously not a feasible way to go. We've got to figure out another way. It's a very, very stringent requirement. I'm sure people are aware of this. What we're talking about for wealthy countries is emissions reductions of roughly 90% by 2050. So it means very radical changes in what we do. And the magnitude of the emissions requirements are such that we cannot really just sort of take a technological approach. We've got to also address our scale. Because what's happened over the last decades, and I'll get into this in a minute, is that the technological improvements we're making are continually wiped out by the growth in our scale of consumption and production. In September of 2009, a worldwide group of ecologists wrote a paper in Nature in which they argued that we should be measuring what they call planetary boundaries or safe operating space. They were trying to get away from the language of limits to growth, which was used in the 1970s and had a lot of pushback from economists who argued there can be no limits to growth. We can grow indefinitely as long as we dematerialize, and I'll get back to that in a minute. But they identified nine crucial planetary boundaries and argued that we had already exceeded the safe operating space on three. Obviously, climate is one, biodiversity, and the nitrogen cycle, that we were beginning to bump up and get close on a number of others, like ocean acidification, land system change, freshwater use, and so forth. So these are all ecological issues that you've probably read about and heard a fair amount about in the papers over the last couple of years. Now, the conventional wisdom, as I said, is that we can continue to grow and leave our economic system more or less as is, and we'll be able to solve ecological problems merely through technological changes. The most important of those, of course, is switching to clean energy system or renewable energy system. But the dematerialization hypothesis, which has been around since the 1970s and was the standard answer to the limits to growth debate, and are people familiar with that? Basically, in the 1970s, a group of modelers from MIT, associated with James Forrester, build a model. They were coming out originally from concerns about population growth because of the high population growth rates of the 1960s. But they were interested in more than that and worried about more than that. They were also looking at pollution. And basically, they did a model which showed that if industrial production continued to increase at the rates that it was, there was going to be a kind of system collapse, actually right about now, right about 2010. They anticipated a global economic collapse as well as an ecological collapse. Now, there were a lot of things. They had a very simplistic model. There was a lot of stuff wrong with it. The economists hated it because it didn't have prices in there. And it focused too much on non-renewables like oil, because in the 1970s, there was also a big fear about peak oil. So when oil prices soared in the 70s, of course, there was a lot of oil exploration, and we went through a period of low oil prices. And so people thought the limits folks were all wrong because the prices of commodities were falling in the 1980s. What they didn't focus on was the non-renewable, the renewables, like the climate system, for example, as well as what might happen to the non-renewables eventually. And of course, we have big increases in commodities prices over the last decade or so, and we'll see what happens with those. But the economist's view was we can continue to grow in value terms, that is in dollar terms, because we're going to dematerialize, that is reduce the amount of ecological resources used for per dollar of output. And there has been some of that. We've had a little over 1% a year of reduction in what we would call the material intensity, if you want to measure it by materials. There's also carbon intensity, which is another way of doing it, which has had a fairly similar reduction, 1.1, 1.2% over the last 25 years or so. So there has been some progress. That's the technological approach. But the scale, both of population, of course, and much more importantly, of income, of GDP per person globally, has been much greater than it has more than outweighed the decline in materials intensity or carbon intensity. So over the last 25 years, we now have actually starting to get some good data on materials use on a global basis. The Europeans have invested a fair amount of money on this. There's almost none of this going on in the United States. But on a worldwide basis, there's been about a 45% increase in total material extraction worldwide. So dematerialization is not happening. What's called relative decoupling or relative dematerialization is happening a little bit. That is the breaking apart of the relationship between GDP and materials use. So there's been some improvement on what's called the relative side, but in terms of actual materialization, there continues to be high levels of growing levels of material use. And in North America and the United States also particularly, in fact, we've had greater than average. So the global average was that 45% increase over the last 25 years. We've had greater than average increase in materials use in the last 25 years, which is, you know, anomalous from a standard economic point of view, because as such a rich and technologically developed country, we should be at the forefront of reducing materials intensity. You can see the two big components of this here, fossil fuels, because we have a very obviously wasteful fossil fuel regime, and particularly the low fossil fuel prices over most of this period led to building infrastructure, consumer practices, industrial practices, and so forth that were very wasteful of energy. The other big thing you see here in the green is the construction boom, because the housing boom, and you know we saw what's happened to that. But housing is one of the most, and buildings are one of the most materials intensive things that we do. And they also waste a tremendous amount actually of material waste in building. So dematerialization isn't happening on anything like the scale that it needs to. If we got a good, nice, high, stiff price on carbon, that would help tremendously, but it's unlikely, I think, going forward, particularly over the next 10 years or so, which is when we really have to make big changes in what we're doing in terms of our carbon use. that it's going to be able to come just from the technological side. Now, the ecological situation means that we have to drastically reduce our eco impact in a short period of time, our carbon impact and our eco footprint more generally. This is made much more difficult right now because we are in the middle of an unemployment crisis. And the standard approach to unemployment and the downturn of an economy is what? It's to grow. It's to stimulate your economy. And if you think back to that conversation that happened around the stimulus and the downturn in the economy, it was all about how to just get the economy growing no matter what you were growing on, for the most part. I mean, there was some discussion about green jobs, but for the most part, it's really been how can we get people back to doing what they were doing before? And that's a disaster from the point of view of the environment. It's also, I think, a stupid economic strategy, because what we were doing before has not been all that successful in terms of well-being. It's generated a lot of inequality. We are continuing to decline in terms of our position in the world. It was a consumption-led regime, which is not sustainable. So there were a lot of problems with the economic regime that we were coming through. So I don't have time to go through all of these in detail. I think people are probably really aware of what's happened to income and asset distribution over the last 25 years. They've become grossly much, much more unequal. The United States has surged ahead now into sort of global south kinds of levels of inequality, particularly in the last 10 years at the very, very top. Yes?
Do you have a comparison? Just from the list of countries that sort of overconsume per their population, how much of it does it correlate with unequal distribution of wealth?
I don't think I've seen a paper on that. That would be an interesting one to do. It's possible it's out there, but I haven't. I'm not seeing one. Certainly, one of the things we know is that some of the lower footprint countries, if you compare across the OECD, for example, tend to be higher equality countries. On the other hand, you have to control for some other things.
Control for overall wealth, because with Afghanistan, the bottom, it didn't seem that was about income inequality.
But I'm saying even among the OECD or even just the wealthier OECD, but you have some of the Scandinavian countries, for example, have high equality but high footprints because of climate, so you need to control for a number of things. But there may be a relationship there. I would not be surprised. There is a relationship between income inequality and some other kinds of ecological measures. I just haven't seen one on eco footprint. But one of the other things that whatever we do economically, one of the things that's really important is that we need to move forward in ways that increase people's well-being and create wealth. And by this, I mean true wealth, not the paper wealth that we had in the financial boom with the fictitious profits there, or the kinds of fictitious profits which are generated when we're not counting the ecological degradation that we're doing. And that's a whole other sort of, issue that we're going to have to get into eventually once we start doing ecological accounting, to see how much of what we are thinking is real increases in value actually turns out. We're just not measuring it. In the same way that I think people have made pretty compelling arguments in your world about the values of networks and the value of decentralization and so forth, I think there are important arguments to be made in offline economic activity. We need a politics to make this happen. So I call this new model plenitude, and it's an integrated kind of thinking which will addresses both the economic challenges that we face as well as the ecological. So just a few comments about what the model is. Some of the things which I'm not going to talk too much about is clearly we need to move to new kinds of production systems, which are closed-loop systems that don't generate the kinds of pollution that are causing these ecological problems. I think a really important part of this, and I'll say a little bit more about it in a minute, is
to increase what I call in the book eco-knowledge or ecological knowledge. If we think about the industrial paradigm, the industrial system that we've been in since the beginning in the 18th century, but you know, much more classic industrialization that began in the 19th century, because nature was basically treated as a free good for more than two centuries, and businesses and technological innovation focused on technical change that minimized the use of the non-free goods, that is the scarce goods, labor in particular, but also capital. So we've had a path of technical innovation very highly skewed toward nature using, and of course nature wasting technologies rather than nature saving technologies. So one of the big things, as we think about shifting sustainability, it's about basically treating nature as a scarce good, dramatically increasing the resource or natural resource productivity of production systems and also consumption patterns and so forth. But we're sort of two centuries behind on this in terms of developing ecological knowledge that would allow us to have technological innovation that dramatically increases that resource productivity. And in fact, you know, it's worse than that in the sense that we've moved away, particularly in agriculture, from many of the practices which were resource saving. So closed loop systems, for example, in which all waste products became inputs into other systems. So ecological knowledge is key. We need to speed up the growth of the production of ecological knowledge and then its diffusion. And that's where I think open source issues are really important for diffusion of new ecological information and also of ecological skills. So not just learning new ways to do things, but then also teaching people how to implement them. This next point I'm going to get to in a minute, but I think a key component of this is reducing hours in what I call business as usual economy, borrowing that term from the climate debate, that is the sort of standard formal economy that we have, in which nature is treated as a free good, building time wealth for people. This then helps lead us to a growing sector, ecological green sector of small-scale enterprises, many of which have new kinds of property forms, whether we're talking about cooperatives or common-held property, sharing schemes, and so forth. And this connects with the time issue, investing more in social capital and common property. Now, the first principle of plenitude, and I'm going to basically talk about two of them here, there are four that I discuss in the book, is to begin to move people's hours out of BAU, business as usual jobs. This is the path of working hours in six major economies, advanced economies from 1870 to 1970. And what you see here is that there's a very substantial decline in our annual hours of work from about 3,000 hours per year in the last part of the 19th century. That's a 60-hour work week, to about roughly under 2,000 hours, down to about 1,800 hours by 1973. This is important for two reasons. One is that we would have never been able to reabsorb all the labor which is displaced through technical change over this 100-year period if we had not had declines in hours of work. It's really important, and it's something that has particularly been forgotten in the United States, where the debate about how to regain full employment or how to, you know, increase jobs and so forth is only about increasing aggregate levels of GDP, and has pretty much forgotten that shorter hours of work have been central to absorbing labor. Now, particularly in a time when you have constraints on how rapidly you can grow, shorter hours of work is particularly important. In the United States,
since 1973, we've actually had increases in average hours of work. This is a slightly different. Our problem is also that we need to not just get back on that path of declining hours that we were on, and by the way, which Europe is still on, but that we have to turn around a major increase in hours over this period. So we have a gap in hours between European countries and the United States now, anywhere from about 150 for the highest hour countries to almost 400 hours a year for the lowest European hour country. So these are quite significant differences now in hours of work. And we can discuss this more, but one of the key points about this is that if we are going to do more than just address technology as a way of reducing footprint and solving the climate crisis, which I've argued we need to do, And we realize we're going to have to do it through addressing the scale of output. If we argue that we cannot keep increasing the scale of the size of our economy in dollar terms, then pretty much the only way to do it is through hours reductions, through allowing people to take productivity growth in the form of shorter hours of work, rather than taking all that productivity growth in the form of more and more and more output. In Europe, people are beginning to understand this, and even people like Nicholas Stern, you know, author of the Stern Report, Anthony Giddens, and so forth, are talking about the idea that given the magnitude of the climate reductions we need, the wealthy countries of the world probably are going to have to stop growing. That is a debate that hasn't yet come to this country, but as soon as we get serious about targets, about climate targets, we are going to see that the numbers don't add up unless we start talking about what's happening to the aggregate rate of growth. And once you start doing that, you can't just ask people to, you know, basically have the equivalent of what is a recession, a permanent recession. You've got to give them something good in return for not having increases in their material footprint. And that's what shorter hours of work does. I can. It's not in the presentation. Let me come back to that, actually, because I probably have a different view than many people do on that. This is just a bivariate relationship between ecological footprint and hours of work. We've also done some modeling on this, controlling for a lot of other factors, but basically, shorter hours of work is associated with lower ecological footprint, and there are a number of reasons for that, even holding income constant. Clearly, if you're trading off income for hours, so people are taking shorter hours of work instead of getting more income, that's not putting purchasing power into the system, so that's not putting more pressure in terms of ecological pressure. But there are also compositional effects in which people change what they do in terms of their activities and their purchases, which lower ecological footprint, controlling for income. So eco-footprint and hours worked. To speak to the point you made earlier about income distribution, that's another variable that would be interesting to put in here, because it may be part of what this effect is. I don't know. So the second principle of plenitude is that So the first principle is that we reduce hours of work in formal sector jobs. Now, some of that's happened already involuntarily. I'm going to suggest that we try and put in policies and do things which will make it possible for individuals to choose shorter hours of work going forward. And that's a whole, you know, longer discussion about the policies. We can get into that. There are a lot of things we could do which will make shorter hours more attractive to individuals, and also there are things we can do to make them more attractive for firms. But the question I want to address now is what happens with those hours? If I'm, let's say we get onto this path, we we don't increase aggregate levels of growth, or we increase much more slowly. We take our productivity growth in the form of more and more leisure time. What are people going to do with this time? If they sit around and sort of like couch potatoes, watch television, we know their well-being isn't going to go up by too much, and they probably would prefer to be earning income and buying new stuff. But there's another kind of activity shift that can happen that actually I think will give people much more well-being, will give them much more economic security and security for unexpected events, which I think are going to increase both because of climate and sort of financial instability. And that is for people to begin to do more what, borrowing a term from the German philosopher Fritjof Bergmann, what he called high-tech self-providing, but basically people learning to make and do more for themselves. And this then is also a spur to green entrepreneurship. So let me show you some examples of what is, and this is actually a trend which has begun fairly significantly, both in the United States and other places. And this is where the technology side of it comes in. So we have permaculture. We know people are doing more and more in terms of vegetable gardening, permaculture being a more advanced, high productivity, agricultural kind of approach, urban gardening, urban poultry, farmers markets, and so forth. So there's a lot going on the agricultural side. There's a lot going on in terms of micro generation of activity, energy, small scale energy activity, solar, wind, biomass, and so forth. There's a growth of what's called DIY, do-it-yourself home building, and the first one here on the top left is a yurt, which is what people build in New England. This is an adobe here, and these others are just some ecological houses made from sustainable, low-cost materials, which are appropriate to the regions in which they're built. Many of these kinds of DIY home construction are being built in community, so people help each other. One day they go and build a yurt on someone's land, and then 2 weeks later they go and do it somewhere else. So they're very low cash ways of doing construction, and they are very low footprint in comparison to the kinds of market-driven housing, which has been extremely expensive and unstable and financially difficult for people. So these are all part of a sort of offline DIY sector, agriculture, home construction, energy. And I'm now involved in doing a series of case studies with a couple of different organizations, MacArthur Foundation, a center called the Center for Humans and Nature out of Chicago, and my own organization, which is the Center for a New American Dream, which is looking at some of these in more detail. Permaculture is one of them, and this is an urban permaculture exhibition in the Netherlands that was held a couple of years ago. This is a group called the Factor E Farm. Are people familiar with them? It's a really interesting group. They got some they converted a soybean farm in Kansas into a what they call a sort of fully replicable open source village community in which they are basically starting from scratch with just their land and almost no capital. They are developing new technologies through an open source process. So this agricultural machine here was built with Fab Lab technology. They put out onto the web the projects that they want. They have a peer, and then they make them freely available to people to replicate. And
they're doing that with both their construction needs and also the machinery needs for agriculture, and they've got a whole series of projects they're involved in, basically permaculture projects, which will allow them to have high productivity agriculture, which minimizes the human labor parts of it, and of course is all green in terms of organic and so forth. They're trying to build the blueprint for this self-sufficient community so then other small-scale communities can replicate it in the future. So I'm going to be doing a more in-depth case study of them. This is the Fab Lab technology, which is now, spreading to many places. And I'm going to be studying the accessibility of this technology for young people particularly. What's really interesting and important, I think, about this, is everyone familiar with the Fab Lab technology? Yeah. I think what's important about it is the very low financial barriers to entry here, because the particularly if you purchase the machines at a community level, the materials costs are so low. So it means that people can start businesses or begin self-providing with fairly low capital requirements. There's a rise of sharing, and this is another one of the case studies I'm going to be doing, which is a little more on the consumption side than the production side, whether we're talking about car sharing, tool sharing. Big increases in across different sectors, couch sharing, home sharing, soup sharing, you name it. Much of it web, not all of it, but almost all of it web-enabled, because what the web has done is dramatically reduced the transaction costs for getting these things together. What the recession has done has changed the calculus of time and money, because it has shifted us much more toward time affluence and money scarcity. And these kinds of sharing schemes thrive under those conditions. And if I'm right that we're going to be in this situation for quite a while in terms of that shift of time and money, then I think this is going to be increasing. I'm also doing a case study on the Transition Town movement, which is a kind of more political movement, getting towns to begin to grapple with what's going to be happening on climate. They also believe we've reached peak oil. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, or whether it matters. But basically, Transition Town initiatives are attempts to make at a town level, at a local level, dramatic reductions in ecological footprint and increases in self-sufficiency and self-reliance. And there are now almost 80 of them operating in the United States. And this was a movement that started in Europe and is worldwide. So these are all a series of case studies that I'm doing that came out of the book that I'm going to be looking at more in depth. And I'll just end by saying that my vision of how this happens is that the BAU economy begins to shrink as people move out of it. They start doing all this self-providing, these small-scale companies start growing, they start interacting with each other and creating a new economy. So it's really a sectoral shift out of the brands and companies that you see here into small-scale, green, alternative kinds of companies, in which their use of technology is pretty central to what they're doing. So let me stop there.
Thank you.
And
yes, so we had one question queued up about population growth.
I'm not going to ask that.
Okay.
If you, I'm interested, but the question that occurred to me is to what extent this model, these ideas are adaptable to developing countries. Or have you given any thought to that at all?
Yeah.
Because you seem to be speaking very much in the U.S. or advanced.
Yeah. Actually, what's interesting about them is a lot of them have been practiced for quite a while now, mm-hmm. in developing countries. This is
some of these are really the vanguard, I would say, of what's interesting in the development field.
Right.
So things like fab labs, for example, which are catching on in places like India, as well as, I mean, much of the basic model here is very applicable to developing country context. So low capital requirements,
right,
small scale, decentralized, appropriate technology, low eco impact.
I'm just saying that's not the mindset of planners in developing countries. So
it's the mindset of some. I mean, it's not the dominant mindset. You know, it's not the World Bank, obviously, but there is a segment of the development community. I mean, coming from, you know, Schumacher in the 1970s. If you look at, you know, some of the more alternative and less mainstream development groups, I think a lot of these kinds of ideas are very much what they're interested in. So I do think what's different about it is that my vision is saying we in the West have a distribution problem when it comes to goods and services. So we've got a highly unequal distribution, but our average levels of wealth are sufficient now for our population. We don't have to try and keep increasing our production levels. We need a different economic system to create well-being and not a growth-driven one. So that's of course different in developing countries where you have lots of poor people who need to increase their eco-footprint. So that's what's different about the two. The model itself, I would say, in some ways is similar. Yes?
I wanted to ask, to what extent does the increasing use of electronics and computer technology, including the web that is enabling some of the things you're talking about, itself contributing to, you know, the resource consumption and ecological problems?
Well, yeah, that is an issue. I mean, I can't give you any numbers on that, but it's definitely a big energy consumer. I do think some of the major companies are starting. Google, for example, is really starting to think about its footprint and go toward renewable energy. I think the mindset in that world is a lot better in terms of moving more quickly than in a lot of the old line industries, who are very resistant to a shifting energy paradigm.
Two points. One on this. The internet or Google search or things like that can also save a lot of energy. If I don't have to get in my car and drive to this and that store to find out who has what at what price, if I could just find it in 5 minutes from home and order it over the internet, I'm not using all of that energy to go and get it or go to look for it. Secondly, much in developing countries, the most effective development tools are these small enabling things like a $50 or $100 or $150 loan for a sewing machine or for chickens or something like this, and let people, you know, do their own thing, rather than being dependent on someone else or to scrape by. They can develop their own enterprise with very little capital, and 99% of those loans get paid back also. So it's a real, the ideal development mode rather than building dams or as we used to.
Yeah, so my model is similar to that. It's not a money-driven model because it's in the sense that financial constraints of that type are not what are preventing people from doing more of this in wealthy countries. I mean, it's very easy for people to get their hands on $150 or $1,000 or even $5,000 in this country. Where we are constrained much more by time, because we work long hours in formal jobs, which people need in order to get access to other things. Health insurance, housing, particularly, and education costs. Those are the, you know, three big things. So what we need to do is think about things in our system that will allow people to de-link from those jobs, which are high footprint jobs, reclaim more of their time, which then enables them to do more of this kind of activity. Why do I think this is a good thing? I mean, you think this sounds kind of crazy. Why would we want to go back to, you know, it's sort of peasant lifestyles in a certain way? I mean, post-industrial peasants, but and maybe urban, but there are, you know, for those of you who have studied agriculture and know what peasant life is like, you know there's some very important peasant features here. What are they? Well, number one, it's diversity of activities and diversity of income streams. So a typical peasant household is doing a lot of different things. They're doing them seasonally, they're weaving, they're spinning, they might be doing soldiering in the winter season, or they might do a little mining. There are certain periods of time where they have to spend a lot of time in the fields. But that diversification of activities and income streams, which is characteristic of a pre-industrial economy, is what I am advocating. And one of the big reasons I'm advocating it is that I believe we're coming in for a time of increasing uncertainty and putting all your eggs in the basket of your big corporate employer is a riskier and riskier strategy, because we have more and more financial collapses, and we're going to have climatic uncertainty, increased weather events and so forth, which are going to make that single income stream strategy, I think, less a less good. So it's a diversification strategy in part, which I think is smart in periods of increased economic or other kinds of instability. And the reason I think it makes sense now, in a way it would not have 50 years ago, is because of technology and new technology. Because what it allows to happen is, at a very small scale, an individual or a small company can be highly productive because of its relationship to networks and to a whole global world out there, both in terms of getting information, making economic connections and transactions, processing information. There are lots of ways in which information technology raises the productivity of the individual and the small-scale enterprise. So it's really the next stage after big. And I have a whole discussion in my book about why large scale, the big economies of scale, are probably going to be less important going forward, and small-scale enterprises are becoming more efficient. I think that's really key in terms of thinking about that, in terms of thinking about that model. Yeah.
Related to that, I was wondering, so, you know, we've seen already through, say, the last two decades, the use of information technology, empowerment of individuals, the rise of networks, and at the same time, the concentration of capital into smaller and smaller numbers of hands. Do you see that changing? And if so, how or why?
Well, what I think, and this is the sort of, I think the title of my talk was, you know, can the internet save the planet or something? I think there's some obvious ways that people are already using the internet for ecological aims. But there are two dimensions of this. One is the one I talked about in my talk, which is sort of ecological knowledge and the transmission of new green technologies and so forth. But the other really important one, you know, very relevant for this place, is the development of a new economic model. And I think that the rise of peer production, collaborative production, and, you know, all the thinking and work around that, and the role of those new kinds of activities in creating a new kind of economy is really central.
And so if you look at these factory farm people, they're trying to create a new, you know, in the business world, they call it business model, but I'd call it a new economic model. But it's sort of one in which actions are taken for a variety of purposes, not just for making money, etc. So there's a way in which I think it's a very interesting question why this is happening. I think the answer to increasing concentration of wealth has more to do with state policy than anything else. So what you've had is large corporations who've captured the state in the last 25 years to a degree, you know, much more than they had in the previous 25. And they've used that state power to change tax laws, to change regulations, to do a variety of things which have created a very rapid increase in money flowing to the top. And we see that going on in the debates, you know, every day in our country. So it is
it's paradoxical what you say, and I think it's true, truly paradoxical. I haven't studied enough to really understand why those two things are happening, but I do think that what's happening on the internet can be the basis of a new economic model, which, should it really thrive, will counter those trends that you're talking about.
I wanted to give you a chance to sort of say a little bit more about how you see the politics behind this movement happening. In part because I think exactly as you described, the last 25 years are really you have that lovely last image of the shrinking circle with all the global multinational logos in it. And I wonder how, what's the, I mean, other than in PowerPoint, what's the mechanism by which you, how do you do that, right? I mean, that's sort of the puzzle that I don't know how to crack. Because I think you've laid out an unbelievable and kind of very broad vision of what the world could be like. But it's the transition stage that's a real pain, potentially. So. Yeah.
So, well, Harry read my book, so he knows I carefully avoided any upfront confrontation with politics in it. I mean, I tried to write it in a very, very unpolitical way because we live in such a politically polarized moment, and if you, it's almost, you know, you put your flag down in one place and you've got, you know, everyone who isn't in that place hating what you have to say. So I really tried to write it very generically. But of course you need a politics to get you to this place. So what the political strategy behind this that I have is the following. The first part is that we lack a viable and, at this point, credible economic alternative to global capitalism. We must build that if we are going to counter global capitalism. We have lots of pieces of it, but we've got to really put it together, and we need to do that work. So there's a lot of intellectual work that needs to be done to say, look, here's a different system. People here are part of that intellectual work. Obviously, some of the most important pieces of it, I think, are happening here. And I'm involved with a number of economist groups and so forth trying to work on that. At the same time, I think we actually need people doing it and living it. So the real life models of alternatives, and that is happening on the ground. But it's happening at a very local level, and it's just happening in certain places. But in certain parts of the country, and now I'm just talking about the U.S. now, in certain parts of the country, it's much more well-developed than in others, like the Pacific Northwest, where there's beginning to be really a sort of much more of an alternative to a sustainable economic alternative. So I think we need to work on those fronts. At the same time, that there are also some kind of system changes that would spur that along, like
single-payer health insurance, which would allow people to delink much more from jobs, for example. So that's sort of my vision, is that we actually need a lot of building work over the next couple of years. We're not in a position to really contest for power from a vision like this. But that the recession provides us with a tremendous opportunity to begin to expand alternatives. There are really fantastic things going on in a lot of these blighted urban cores, like places like Detroit, Cleveland, for example. You have this big cooperative movement going on in Cleveland. So there's innovation happening, local level innovation, and I think we need to foster that and then begin to join up.
And taking up that answer left off, does anybody have a meter on how many people in this country are actually engaging in this sort of do-it-yourself new post-industrial peasantry? And if so, is there any sense of where the practitioners lie largely on the socioeconomic scale?
So the first answer is no.
Okay.
I have a few numbers of a few things in my book. There's this new book out on collaborative consumption, which has a few more numbers, but it's pretty much anecdotal at this point.
I think
over the next couple of years, we'll be able to get some national surveys which ask about some of these questions. So that's the first answer to your first question. And the second one is, this is a movement that started out very, what we call in sociology, high cultural capital, meaning not necessarily very wealthy people, but people with high levels of education and social know-how and contacts. It has begun to change. So some of the really big activity is among low-income people of color in urban areas. The Cleveland, the Detroit, and they're growing food and so on and so forth. Where I think we've seen much less of it is the white working class, which has been more resistant and is just culturally, tends to be more conservative in this country. So it is beginning to be a more socioeconomically diverse movement. I wouldn't have said that 5 years ago.
But if I can just jump in there while others are thinking questions, to go back to where I started. Do you have anything to say about how the educational system of this country can be helpful, which is something that, a lot of us are actually involved in? Because, I'm with Aaron, all you hear is jobs, right? This is the everybody's being beaten into it. And our colleagues from Harvard keep going down to Washington and, steering the economy and going to Wall Street and picking up their benefits on the, on the way out. And what people are taught in undergraduate economics courses about the way the world works is not on the same planet with what you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
So it seems to me like we're really part of the problem here, at Harvard in particular, because, we all of us who had to vote for governor last month got to go vote for, our choice of Harvard graduates and one from BU, so, right? It, no wonder people think what they think, and the people who are setting policies for the country do what they do particularly the economic apparatus of the country replicates itself this way. So it's all, I'm skeptical about the power of the movement that you are describing from the bottom up when the people who fill Congress are coming from places like this.
Absolutely. And, one thing we know about how social change happens is that it's always a combination of
pressure from the bottom and splits among elites. So there's always, the elites begin to diverge, and then, you know, that forward-looking, if you want to, you know, in terms of movements going, then ally with broader, more populist movements. So I absolutely agree with you about the role of economics and the role of even, you know, we can maybe broaden that out to, you know, there's maybe the political scientists too, and so forth. So the question is how to make change in universities. Let's just take economics, what to do about that. I think that it would be very useful if scientists and I guess scientists, you know, could probably be the most effective here, actually began to take more of a role in the university in talking about what students should be taught about the planet and management of the planet, which includes economics. So, they're going to be in a more, scientists, I think, you know, much more than humanists, for example, who are not going to be listened to on this. I mean, that's really a role that scientists could take. One thing that's happened, as you well know, certainly my sense of the elite schools over the last, I don't know how many years, maybe it's since the 1970s, maybe it was before, but the disproportionate role of economists in running these universities.
Absolutely.
And
it's the, you know, it's the one course that half the Harvard student body takes is the party line, you know, freshman economics course.
Yeah. And I mean, I have I was going to put more in my book about this, but ended up, you know, it ended up being a fairly short point. But if you look at the top economics departments around the country, and, you know, this will be true of many non-top two, but not all, they're at most, any of these departments will have one person who works on environmental issues. And so there's a, you know, they talk about the environment being an externality to the market, but it's externalized within the field. This is a, you know, civilizational emergency, and we have departments of 60, 70 people, 69 of whom pay no attention to this issue. And then, you know, we can ask questions about the ones who do and whether they're being paid by the energy companies, because environmental economics has been merged with energy economics, and that's another problem. So I absolutely agree with you. I think that's a political fight that other disciplines could maybe take on. And by the way, the Federal Reserve Board of New York came out with yet another study on of the same, you know, roughly the same issue that the Robert Frank paper that you talked about at the beginning of the seminar, again supporting the view that more economics training made, you know, worse people. So,
David,
I find myself both hopeful and usually depressed, because if this is the way forward, the path to getting there seems to have to counter everything. The most powerful institutions in the world, the most powerful corporations in the world, the rejection by, or at least indifference of, the very people who would, the workers who would benefit from this are not clamoring for this, not thinking about it this way. They need to be educated. Requires a policy like single payer, or would be greatly helped by a policy like single payer, which, if we know anything now, we know we are not going to get single payer. We're not going to get it. You know, what's the path forward? So the timeline to getting here, and we are in a crisis, right, as you just said. The timeline for getting to where we need to be seems to stretch indefinitely, but the time that we have to get there seems to be very, very short. So what do we do? I mean, is this a path that we can afford to travel, or do we need to, you know?
I don't think that, you know, on the one hand, we can say, oh my God, we've got to get our emissions down by X percent in this many years, we have to do this in this many years, and yet we can't because there's all this power arrayed against us, and we can't. I mean, and things are getting worse on that front. Citizens United, and look at what's happened in the last elections and so forth. And so we can look at that and say there's nothing we can do. I don't think that's the right approach. I think what we have to do is step back and say, all right, what is it that we need to build to succeed longer term for the kind of society that we have to build, that we need? There are a lot of bad things that are going to happen. I will go back to my point about global collapse and emissions, and I think we are going to be helped on that front. It's going to be ugly, and you know, part of what we have to do is try and create social connections, visions, a movement that is going to counter the sort of a much more barbaric, fascistic, corporatized, ugly version of green, which is, you know, one of the big things we have to worry about, or just ugly version, period, of non-green. I mean, that's, you know, there's some ugly scenarios out there. And I think we need to be constructing a much more humanistic, egalitarian world that is going to really be good for people, that gives people more freedom, which is what a scenario like this does, which gives people more community, which gives them more safety, security, all of those kinds of things. I mean, that's all we can do. I don't know that we have another choice. What's that?
If I had one, I'd let me know.
Yeah.
All right, Emma, we got three or four more questions. We only got about 5 minutes left, so let's...
You made a remark in the beginning of the talk about the sustainability and kind of the technology communities not being so aligned, which I thought was really interesting and sort of resonated with some experiences that we've had. But I was curious because the examples that you showed seemed to me to be very much ones that combined those two sensibilities. The you know, the use of the term open source by the farming community to, you know, be their banner. And so I guess I'd be interested in hearing more of your thoughts on where you see the disconnects and how maybe that could be bridged going forward. Because I thought that was a really interesting remark, but the examples were ones where it had been bridged, which is probably right. But then the bigger work, I think there is a lot of goodwill and a lot of interest in the sustainability world, and there's a lot of opportunity for people in the technology world to kind of maybe bridge that, but I just would be interested in your thoughts on how that might be done and what are some of the mechanisms for that to happen.
Yeah. These are small-scale examples that I found. I'm coming out of sustainability, a certain type part of the sustainability world, and I just think it's just not on the radar. You know, what's happening in the technology world is not yet on their radar very much. They're like very behind in certain ways.
Sierra Club and NRDC.
Right. I mean, they're sort of, or even some of the smaller groups and some, I mean, those aren't really sustainability, or they're kind of environmental groups. They have some sustainability activity. But they're sort of, you know, still just trying to think about their website, the kind of, you know, it's sort of not, there's like transformative power in what's going on in technology. Transformative power of both knowledge transmission, how we live our lives, and our economic model that those folks are really not thinking along. They're thinking in a much more instrumental way, I would say. How we could do more together. I do feel that in the technology world, there are a lot of people who care about sustainability, and it's a kind of natural, you know, just the demographics of that group, and they're very open to it, and they kind of get it, and they kind of know we have a problem.
So I suppose more institutional connections, for example, more conversations, more meeting at conferences and so forth, that would maybe lead to more. I mean, one thing about your world is that there's just a lot that happens. People meet and then things happen. And that's part of by the way, my answer to how change is going to happen now, which is that we need to just have a lot of innovation.
Okay, we're in the lightning round. Quick questions and quick answers.
Okay, quick question. The pattern that has been employed to get the mileage per gallon down as a goal by the administration, the current administration, in the Congress, do you see that as a pattern to use for other initiatives, sort of a regulatory answer?
Oh, I mean, that's been decades and decades to get marginal change. That's a depressing story, I think, what's happened on that. So I actually think that I'm more an advocate of new technologies that, you know, kind of leapfrog over the old, like, marginal change initiatives. Is that answering your question?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
One behind me.
You said that this movement is mostly highly educated people that are involved at the moment, and yet also people are not willing to give up their hours at work because of important access to, like, education and health care. Do you think it's important to solve those problems before we can actually continue on the path of this of this movement in order to ensure that people do have access to